I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You know, when we think about what is happening in Vermont with COVID-19 and the response to COVID-19, Vermont is doing remarkably well. But many people worry about the return of K-12 students to their local schools, and perhaps even more so about the influx of out-of-state college students to some of Vermont's communities like Burlington, Castleton, Middlebury, and Bennington. About 2 weeks ago, Governor Phil Scott gave local municipalities more tools to help address the concerns that some of these college towns, and specifically Burlington, were voicing. The governor's August 14th order allows towns to limit the size of both indoor and outdoor gatherings to be more restrictive than state guidelines. And it also allows them to tell bars and restaurants they have to stop serving alcohol earlier than their regular hours. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk to town officials in several communities that have done just that and added other measures to keep a handle on new cases. And then we're going to check in with a regional organization in Woodstock that's been trying to get money to local families in need. Joining us first today is the town manager in Castleton, Michael Jones. Michael is also police commissioner and head of the community's emergency management operations. Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, so let's talk about what's happening in Castleton. A week ago today, the Castleton Select Board passed an order limiting gatherings to 25 people. And the order also allows for fines, $150 for a first offense, $300 for a second offense, up to $500 for a third offense. And as I understand it, people actually are allowed to have gatherings that are larger than 25 people, but they have to get a permit from the town in order to do that. So why did Castleton want to take these steps of limiting the sizes of gatherings?
Well, great question. It really kind of goes back to history. If you live in a college or university type town, it's popular for students, especially when they first get back to on campus, to have large gatherings. And the select board at this point kind of look ahead and said, what's going to happen when the students get back on campus? And knowing that there was also going to be a lesser number of students on campus this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So they thought it was best to limit the number of personnel allowed at a gathering, just to kind of send that message that we want you to do the right thing. This is not just to university students either. This is to everybody. We want you to do the right thing. We want you to put the measures in place that have been put out by the CDC and the Vermont Department of Health to keep yourselves and the public safe. So this measure was the focus on limiting the number of people to kind of, I guess, limit the possibility of contamination if someone is, let's say, asymptomatic, which seems to be growing. Most people that I've talked to that had COVID-19 didn't even know they had it. So they're spreading it, and they don't even know it. So they're not doing it maliciously. They just are not aware. So this limit, the number of people per event will help limit large numbers and maybe cross-contaminating.
You know, we've been seeing in some school communities, you know, like the UNC community, lots of students testing positive and schools having to shut down even basically before they've gotten started with in-person learning. But it sounds like, at least for the Castleton Select Board, it wasn't that your community was looking at what was happening in other college towns around the country and kind of coming to this idea that something needed to be done just in the last few days. As I understand it, you'd been thinking about restrictions even before the governor put out the order August 14th, allowing towns to make these kinds of restrictions. And maybe even before the mask mandate, you were already thinking about what could be done as students returned to Castleton?
I believe that's partially correct, because we had, at a previous select board meeting, a member of the community call in asking the select board to adopt a policy for mandatory mask wearing while in public. So the community, the chatter that I saw on social media, Front Porch Forum seems to be a popular source in the town of Castleton to discuss things. And it seemed there was a concern before the school, before the university had even started talking about how they were going to reopen, that there was members in the community that were concerned what was going to happen or what could happen when a large number of students came back onto the, on campus. So I think that that's a true statement. I can't speak for, I'm not going to speak for all the select board members, but I know that there was a select board member looking at what was happening in Burlington with some interest.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see, you know, various communities try to make plans and try to preempt any kind of cases, you know, or any worries that might be addressed by a townwide measure. But, you know, when you think about the possibility of spread, whether it's a gathering of 25 people or fewer, it can happen pretty quickly in a community. Are you hearing, you mentioned Front Porch Forum, are you hearing concerns in the wider Castleton community as students are returning and as you're seeing, you know, the sort of the signs of what September might look like? Or are people pretty satisfied with the response and with the responsibility of students?
I really haven't seen much on social media lately, in the last couple weeks, expressing those concerns. The university held a town meeting last week, and the public had a chance to call in and talk to university faculty, staff, and also with representation from the Castleton Health Center. And myself and the police chief were on, and they had a chance to ask questions at that point. And there was a lot of good questions asked. Basically, what people were asking is, what is the university doing to help mitigate risk, both before the students arrived, and then upon arrival, and then subsequent to the university starting classes? And everything is virtual at this point, but there are people living in the dorms. So some folks were worried about this outbreak that could happen with students in, you know, out and about in the community. And I'm not really sure how valid that argument was. If they're being tested before they arrived, you know, shortly after they arrived, and then subsequent to that, versus just anybody in the public. So I haven't really seen a lot, but, you know, in the last 2 weeks, about concern. Hopefully the questions were answered both by articles in the Rutland Herald and the town meeting that was held last week.
Does it feel like Castleton University and Castleton municipal officials and the police department that everybody's sort of working well together? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of cooperation.
Well, there certainly is. And at the town meeting, I mentioned that if I had to pre-script this thing, I don't think we could have done much better because early on, the university partnered with the Castleton Health Center and Dr. Berryhill and his staff. And our police chief always works closely with the university security staff. So, and I had a meeting with the president of the university, and we discussed some of this stuff. So I think that the town and all the stakeholders here, the health center, the university, and the town have worked well to try to get the word out there of what they're doing and to mitigate risk.
You know, I mentioned that with these gathering restrictions to 25 people, unless you get a permit, there are fines that can be levied, $150 for a first offense, and it goes up from there. Is there concern, though, about whether those fines will actually be enacted, but also the time it could take to have to be making sure that these rules are being followed, and if there's paperwork assigned to dealing with the fines, and then maybe processing permits for gatherings larger than 25, could this become a little bit of a headache?
I'm not really sure how much of a headache it could be. It certainly is a different protocol than we normally follow. So, but I think, you know, we're all on the same sheet of music on how it's going to work. And the first steps that we took was to get the word out there via social media, but we also sent, I sent copies of the resolution, or the basically it's a policy adopted by resolution, to the primary landlords in town, and the police chief also was able to deliver some, and then the police department delivered to some of these rental locations and handed off copies of this policy to the the renters. So first part was education, make sure everybody knew about it, and before we start levying fines. It's a civil process, so it will have to go through its normal adjudication, but just like anything that we would do, this is just something new, that's all.
Michael, before I let you go, on Friday, the 21st of August, and this is before the restrictions were enacted, at an off-campus party of about 75 students, one Castleton University student stabbed a fellow student, and two others were injured while trying to break up the fight. I imagine that has had a pretty big impact on the mood around Castleton.
Well, I think the mood has been more out of curiosity of what really happened. So there was an article in the paper that explained it. And so, yeah, anytime something like that happens in a small town, there's going to be talk about it. But I didn't see anything on social media. I didn't receive any phone calls with folks that were really worrisome about it. Because my first questions were, you know, was anybody, was there, first of all, an officer involved? Was there any concern for public safety, like someone had escaped and got away and they were still looking for them? Is everybody okay? So I think that I have not heard, I have not heard of any real concern about the incident, more curiosity about what happened.
Well, thanks for letting us know and keep us posted on all things that are happening in Castleton as we move through the summer, end of summer and beginning of fall. Michael Jones is Castleton Town Manager, Police Commissioner, and Head of the Community's Emergency Management Operations. Michael, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you and have a great day.
Let's look at what's happening in Vermont's most populous community and biggest concentration of students. Max Tracy is president of the Burlington City Council, which enacted a handful of preemptive public health orders last week. Max, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. Really appreciate it.
So Burlington's restrictions limit gatherings like Castleton to 25 people, but that's for outside. The limitation inside is 10 people. And you've added a last call for bars and restaurants of 11 p.m. For serving alcohol, which is a lot earlier than a lot of Burlington bars and restaurants have been able to serve alcohol in the past. Why did Burlington need these restrictions?
Well, with, you know, close to 10,000 students at the University of Vermont, many of, you know, two-thirds of whom are actually over two-thirds of whom are coming from out of state, and those students coming from 48 out of 50 states in the United States, you know, it was really out of concern and preemptive concern around large gatherings that we especially tend to see at this time of year when students come back and are having those larger gatherings both in indoor and outdoor settings. In the case of bars, there's also a concern that prolonged time spent in an indoor setting where there's loud music and where people would be drinking and ostensibly not having their masks on the whole time that they're consuming beverages, that there would be a heightened risk of concern around transmission in those settings.
You know, as we talked with Michael about the Castleton restrictions, you know, if bars are not allowed to serve past 11 p.m. and gatherings in the city are only 25 people outside, 10 inside, that applies not just to students, but to a whole community. So what are you hearing in terms of feedback from the wider Burlington community about support for these restrictions or perhaps pushback against them?
So I haven't heard much in the way of pushback against them from sort of the broader community. Certainly, bar and restaurant owners were not crazy about the idea of having folks, you know, having to shut down several hours earlier than they might usually do so. However, you know, in terms of the broader community, I have heard support for taking these measures, given that there was really significant concern around UVM reopening.
Not just UVM, there are, you know, usually about 2,000 students at Champlain College. Are there other sort of populations that you're concerned about, or is UVM really the primary focus?
UVM has really been the primary focus. Certainly, we're in collaboration with folks at Champlain, and they've been very responsive as well and collaborative. But, you know, UVM tends to be the larger focus of this, given that they are, you know, the largest institution in the state.
Are you satisfied with the response from UVM about how to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19 on campus and throughout the Burlington community?
You know, I think that they've made some necessary changes to their policies and have responded to some feedback that's been received, but I'm not completely satisfied with regards to their off-campus strategies, both in terms of off-campus social distance enforcement. It feels as though that's really been pushed off to the city and said, you know, have the Burlington police really take care of that enforcement. And then also just in terms of support for campus students who might, you know, need to quarantine should they test positive. You know, it's not altogether clear how and what they're doing to really support those kinds of students who are in those situations.
In terms of monitoring or keeping an eye on students who are UVM students but who are living off campus, what would you like the university to be doing that it's not when it comes to monitoring behavior and maybe making sure that all the protocols are being followed?
So I'd really like for them to have a line that folks in the community who are seeing these student parties or gatherings take place, where folks could be able to call in real time and get a response from an actual person, and that then that would key off a response from an actually trained UVM staff member who would then engage the students who were involved in that violation directly in that moment, in that conversation around the violation that was taking place, as opposed to just having folks call the police, which you know, is something that has, I think, limited efficacy given all the other things that the police have going on any given evening or any given day for that matter.
As I understand it, when the city council enacted these public health orders last week, the council did not give the mayor authority to decree future restrictions. It's going to have to be done by the council in a council meeting. Why not give the mayor more flexibility?
I think the council really wants to be able to weigh in on these and have a chance to shape the policy themselves. I think there was an acknowledgement, though, you know, that should changes need to be made, that the council is willing to be flexible as far as our meeting schedule. We adopted those prior changes in the context of a special meeting, and there was recognition that if we aren't giving the mayor that flexibility, that then we would have to be willing to come back maybe outside of our normal meeting schedule to make changes. And I think that folks are willing to do that.
That's Max Tracy, president of the Burlington City Council. Max, thank you very much for talking us through some of the restrictions that the Burlington City Council has enacted to try to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Today, we're looking at how municipalities are crafting their own individualized responses to the potential spread of COVID-19, particularly by an influx of college and university students this fall. But you could see it also applied in other scenarios where there might be, say, lots of tourists gathering or other issues that could need to be dealt with on a town-by-town basis. We've heard from a couple of Vermont municipal officials, and similar questions are being raised in Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth College has said it's bringing back half of its student body for in-person instruction. Julia Griffin is the town manager in Hanover and joins us now to talk about what that community is doing in response. Hi, Julia. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you, Jane.
So we have been looking at what's been happening in Vermont communities since Governor Phil Scott enacted an order on August 14th allowing communities, municipalities to enact stricter guidelines. Is there a similar situation in New Hampshire where towns are allowed to enact stricter guidelines?
So there isn't a specific order that's been issued by Governor Sununu enabling that. And so what cities and towns in New Hampshire are doing instead is using a specific state statute that governs the role that our public health officers play in communities to establish individual community guidelines based on a public health situation or an outbreak. And so we're relying on that statute to implement everything from mandatory mask ordinances to some components that the Hanover Select Board will be considering in a public hearing this evening, intended to address even more specifically the potential problem of off-campus gatherings of students that could prove problematic once students come back to Dartmouth.
Yeah, and among the measures the Hanover Select Board will be considering tonight, public gatherings be limited to 10 people, all gatherings requiring a designated host who would keep the guests' names, phone numbers, emails, physical addresses, presumably in order for contact tracing to be done should there be an outbreak. And along those lines, in terms of contact tracing, I understand all property owners would be able to have to provide the name, phone, email, physical address of all occupants of a property, whether or not they're on the lease, and there would be some fines attached to these. Do I have that all right?
That's correct. And it what it reflects is a challenge that, that many college and university towns have with off-campus housing, primarily inhabited by students, but not exclusively. Very often the housing, rental housing, is inhabited by signatories to the lease, but inevitably others get added to that housing family, so to speak. And it can be really difficult, especially if you're doing contact tracing, to figure out just who might be living in a location or who might have attended a gathering in a location in the event there's a concern that there's been COVID exposure.
So, you know, how worried do you think the community is? Because we've certainly seen in, as I mentioned, in some college communities and some college campuses in particular, a lot of initial spread of COVID-19 when students return. But it looks like a lot of our area colleges and universities have pretty good plans in place to try to prevent that from happening. So, you know, what is the feeling in Hanover as Dartmouth plans to bring back half of its student body?
So it's fascinating, Jane, when you sort of peel back the layers. Dartmouth has a superb plan with a very high level of testing. They've gone above and beyond, in my estimation, to develop a reentry plan that I think is very thoughtful and very thorough. But residents are still very worried. And this is a college town, so we feel sort of schizophrenic about this. Mm. Our downtown needs these students. So many people work for the college, and the vitality of the community depends on sort of an active college life and also visitors to the college. And so we don't want to see our downtown business community shuttered again. We don't want people to lose their jobs. And yet we're very afraid of the potential for COVID to come back to town, either transported by a student who might be coming from another part of the country where there are more COVID cases, or just from the sort of typical student socializing that you tend to see on campus and off campus when students are back together. And we've certainly seen this happening on other campuses across the country that have convened earlier than Dartmouth will. And so it's the fear of the unknown, I think, right now that has local residents anxious. And yet they will all tell you they understand as well why it's important that we try and regain some sense of normalcy. So, as I talk to our residents, I say, look, we have to take these things one day at a time and just know that Dartmouth has got a very thorough testing and quarantine and retesting and then more quarantine and then retesting again protocol in place for its students as they return.
Well, you know, how do you as town manager and how do townspeople and Hanover at large navigate? You know, there's sometimes we think about the town gown relations and what can either be a separation of a college community and a town community or a commingling and a really good relationship. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about students and whether students will do the right thing or not. And students do this and students do that. But, you know, in a community like Hanover or Middlebury or Burlington, students are part of the community. So how do you bring them in, given that most of them are not physically there yet, to this conversation so that everybody feels like they have a responsibility to their community?
Yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of your articulation of this question. The students are very much a part of our community, and trying to figure out as in a leadership position how you consult them, but you also have to make decisions based on the entire community's need and walk a fine line between not implementing ordinances or regulations, for example, that they think are overbearing, and yet knowing that in order to to ensure that you're maintaining that same level of safety for the community off campus as Dartmouth will be maintaining on campus. You really need local regulations to be stepped up to create kind of a belt and suspender situation for students who may be enrolled but living off campus and not under the close watch of Dartmouth staff who are going to be keeping a very close watch on their on-campus inhabitants. So it's tough because we are a college community. Our students register to vote here. They're very active locally. They work closely with many agencies and organizations and volunteer their time. They support our downtown businesses. And our challenge is we wish that every student were as responsible as those who are, say they will be when they return. We just know from our longtime experience as hosts in a college community that you have one element of the student body that's really responsible and another element, particularly when alcohol is present, that tends to tend toward the irresponsible. And right now, when the stakes are so high, it's so important that we keep everybody healthy, and particularly in a town like Hanover, where we also have this interesting coalescence. We have a lot of retirees here. Many of them are Dartmouth alums. They're here because of the college, and they're also here because Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center is here with top-flight medical care. So we have a larger-than-average percentage of retirees living in the community who are scared to death of acquiring COVID.
So to speak, yeah. Boy.
Trying to balance all of these somewhat competing interests is what we're all about right now as we try and sort of walk that balance beam and figure out how to do right by everybody.
Well, Julia, I really appreciate you telling us a little bit about what you're trying to negotiate and navigate, and thank you and good luck.
Thanks so much, Jane.
That's Julia Griffin, town manager for Hanover, New Hampshire. We've heard from several individual communities as we look at what towns are doing to address COVID-19, but let's now turn to someone who can help give us a broader perspective on these municipal issues and how they're being dealt with across our state and region. Karen Horn is Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. Hi, Karen. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
So we've heard from Castleton, we heard from Burlington, we heard from just over the river in Hanover, New Hampshire, where it's a little bit different in terms of state guidelines, but Hanover certainly considering some restrictions addressing college students' return. What are you seeing in terms of the ways Vermont communities are trying to think about gatherings, particularly around colleges, but as I said at the beginning, you know, it could be ski towns that see an influx of people at certain times of the year or other towns that might be thinking about, you know, how do we address the very specific needs of our communities?
Yeah, so we are seeing a lot of concern around those issues. And as Julia said, trying to balance welcoming tourists and visitors throughout the summer, and particularly as leaf peeping season sort of approaches, with the needs to maintain everybody's health and keep people safe. So I think that the college towns, as you've been talking about here, are sort of the first ones to put in place those additional requirements for smaller gatherings and earlier bar hours. I haven't heard a lot of other towns doing that at this point in time. On the other hand, I do know that bar owners in particular, and if you think about the craft brewing industry around Vermont, are being very responsible and careful in the way that they have opened up throughout the summer and how they're hoping to keep that going into the fall. The administration, for instance, is proposing a grant program that would allow those kinds of places and our restaurants and bars and craft brew places to get winter tents and those propane flares that let you extend the season outside. So there's a lot of conversation going on right now, but towns are very concerned that they're able to help keep businesses open and alive as COVID continues into the fall and winter.
So, you know, it's interesting, Karen, because, you know, there, what you're saying is you're hearing a lot of towns and a lot of individual businesses who really want to do their part to make sure that we can keep our numbers low in Vermont. But here on Vermont Edition, we also sometimes hear from individuals who say, you know, I live in a part of the state that has had very few cases, if any at all. You know, my community is really suffering. Couldn't my town have less restrictive measures than the state guidelines? Are you hearing any pushback on the town level on that side of things from places that say, look, we don't have these same issues. We're not a college town. We haven't had a lot of spread. We're in a place where, you know, we don't have these issues. We need to open up our businesses. Could we have flexibility on that side?
We haven't really heard a lot of pushback against the governor's guidance and the Agency of Commerce and Community Development guidance. It has tended to be fairly flexible in terms of what it will allow, if as long as you maintain the social distancing and the mask wearing and keep the activities outside as much as possible. So we really haven't heard a lot of that, even from those parts of the state where there are very few cases. I mean, actually, there's very few cases anywhere in Vermont right now.
Yeah, luckily.
You know,
when it comes to communities trying to make themselves whole, and we're going to talk in a few minutes with an organization that's trying to make individual families whole who are really struggling. But, you know, town finances are going to take a big hit, we anticipate. How, you know, is there any assistance for municipalities as they're looking to the fall and winter? And, you know, you think about towns, just thinking about town maintenance budgets and transportation budgets and plowing for the winter and, you know, whether the tax revenue is going to come in when it's supposed to. You know, what are you doing to address these issues and to try to work through them?
Yeah, that's really sort of the million-dollar question. Right now, there is a lag, clearly, in terms of municipal revenues. People paid property taxes last November, and then through the spring, there are quite a few towns that have multiple tax due dates for installments. Most of those taxes came in pretty close to what other years tax revenues had been, you know, the same percentage of payment of taxes. I think you're going to see that change as we go forward. Most towns are going to have their taxes due in November. Some towns are having installments due in September and October and then through the winter. We did a survey in July. And of the 107 towns that had responded, it was the second survey. So I think there may be some survey fatigue on our part. But we had 107 towns respond. 27.9% of those towns said they'd been asked for residential property tax relief. 19% had been asked for commercial property tax relief. 16% had been asked for help with water bills and utility assistance and other fees. And then 15% had been asked for help with community services, addressing things like food and meals and housing. So towns are being asked to do a whole lot more than is sort of usually in their wheelhouse. And they're being asked to do it with less going forward. I think we're going to see a very different and not great picture come the spring, you know, as we come out of this winter.
Mm-hmm.
There is the legislature provided $13 million in grants for towns to be compensated for money that they had spent on COVID. So that's like retrofitting your offices, sanitizing, cleaning supplies, those kinds of things, masks. Those are out of the coronavirus relief funds. It's federal dollars. it does not replace lost revenue, which is a big problem. And we're hoping that there will be federal aid. You've had our congressional delegation on quite a few times over the course of the summer talking about trying to get that assistance at the federal level. But the one thing I wanted to mention about the money, the local government economic restoration grants that's coming from the coronavirus relief funds is that the deadline for applying is September 4th. So that's, we'll have a much better picture of what towns are looking for right now, even at the end of this week.
Well, we will find out that information and make sure to report it. And we'll get more information about the survey that you've just been talking about as well, because really interesting stuff there as towns struggle, as we all do, to try to figure out how to address this economic crisis and public health crisis. Karen, thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Karen Horn is Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. And we were talking about the fact that it's not just restrictions that municipalities are looking at. Many are also trying to figure out how to be most helpful to local residents who are struggling with childcare issues, unemployment, an inability to pay rent or their mortgage or their property taxes. One organization that's working to help is in Woodstock, where a volunteer group called WARF, Woodstock Area Relief Fund, has collected more than $550,000 in donations for Central Vermont communities suffering setbacks. Jill Davis is a member of WARF, and we've got her on the line now. Hi, Jill.
Hello, Jane.
So it's interesting to hear about not just municipalities trying to do things, but then volunteer organizations taking things into their own hands. And $550,000 is a lot of money. So how is WARF distributing that?
So far we've distributed $400,000 of that money, and it's helping people pay their rent and their mortgage, their property taxes, utilities. The biggest part has gone to rent and mortgage and utilities, and then some has gone on childcare, and some has gone on personal care and food, and some on car payments.
How do you determine how much money to give to an individual or family who may be suffering a great need?
So we've been asking the question, what is it that you're not able to pay compared to what life was like before COVID-19? And then we've tried to restrict our applications to about $1,000 a month. And a lot of the work we've done is to put people in touch with other organizations, either in the region or in state programs, so that we don't pay what we know other people could pay.
There's sort of a reverse of that happening, though, as well, right, where some relief aid that families or individuals might be entitled to isn't coming to them necessarily if authorities know they've gotten some assistance from your organization, which seems like a totally unintended consequence.
Yes, we had a couple of examples of that. So one applicant is in a family of six, and she's been on the Tree Square program to receive benefits way before COVID-19. And then when she came to us for help, we gave her some help. She went back to the Three Squares program and updated her information. And then she was docked the money that we had given her. So one of our team players is Charlie Kimball, our representative. So he gets tossed all the issues like that. And he's been able to talk to the people in the different organizations to get that resolved so that our short-term help doesn't hinder a long-term program.
Well, right, because if people are still not able to meet their basic needs, even with the federal assistance that they're getting assistance from WARF, if that then curtails the federal assistance, doesn't solve the problem that you were trying to solve in the first place.
No, it doesn't. So it's definitely an unintended consequence.
You mentioned that a lot of the assistance that you've been giving is to help cover rent and mortgage payment or utility bills. We also know that as people anticipated, perhaps children returning to school or as they're looking at childcare situations and not all of them reopening, that childcare is a big issue. Is that something that WARF is seeing more need for or more requests for?
Yes. So through the summer, we helped pay tuition on a couple of different summer programs. And then we're anticipating that we'll get many more requests for tuition as people are having to pay extra childcare for all children when they can't go to school.
Hmm. Jill, if people want to help, where can they find WRF?
So we have a website, woodstockcommunitytrust.com. That's our fiscal sponsor. And you can go there and then donate or apply if you need the money.
And we will put a link up at vpr.org for people who want to get more information, either to offer some financial assistance or to request it. Jill, thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Jill Davis is a member of WRF, the Woodstock Area Relief Fund. And again, we have information at vpr.org.